Hello, and welcome to the Guardian Books podcast. I'm Richard Lee. From Broadway to Hollywood, from Friends to Fox and Friends, our cultural lives are so enthralled to the United States that it feels like familiar territory, even if we've never set foot in the land of the free. But how well do we really know the USA? This week, we welcome the journalist Lawrence Wright and the novelist Amy Bloom, two authors shining a light on less familiar corners of the American story. We think we know about Eleanor Roosevelt, but her relationship with the Associated Press journalist Lorena Hickok is a part of the First Lady's life which is often forgotten. Amy Bloom puts it center stage in her latest novel, White Houses, which imagines what it would have been like for a female journalist in the 1930s to admire the President of the United States and be madly in love with his wife. When she joined Sean Kane in the studio, Bloom began by reading from a novel that gives Lorena voice.
We think we'll remember it all, and we remember hardly anything. Even when the car is only doing 40, it's still going too fast. The trees are a green and gray blur. The restaurant where we thought we'd die laughing over the misspelled menu has come and gone. Neon green streaks and bolts of flamingo pink blow up the sky on a winter night in Maine, and we think, oh, we will never forget these northern lights. But we do. What we remember is only the curling picture in the left-hand drawer, Maine, 1934, or a gorgeous half-page photo in an old travel magazine, but what we saw when we held hands, lifting our chins to the sky as if we could leap into the jagged, jeweled brilliance above us, was seen for 10 seconds only, and never again. Eleanor loved the theater. She was mad for Cole Porter, and there wasn't a song of his she didn't know. She nodded to everyone. She clasped every hand. The house lights dimmed, and Eleanor kissed me on the palm, and she whispered in tune, "You're the top. You're Mahatma Gandhi, you're the top. You're Napoleon Brandy," and I thought, I will remember this, and I do. We were in the rose garden and ducked behind a tower of pale pink roses to kiss. We walked upstairs and passed the Secret Service man, and Eleanor said, "Good evening, Wyatt. I'm in need of repair," and he said very warmly, "Yes, ma'am." And she said, "This party will run another 2 hours, don't you think?" And he looked at his watch. "That's what we were told, ma'am." We race-walked into her bedroom as if we were hell-bent on finding safety pins, and her sequin jacket slid to the floor, and with it her 3-story white orchid corsage, which would have to reappear in an hour or so. She said, "Do not touch that thing." She pulled me onto the bed. I didn't think, I have to remember this. But I have.
Well, Amy Bloom, welcome to the Guardian Books podcast.
Nice to be here.
I have to profess ignorance from the get-go because before I read this book, I'd never actually heard of Lorena Hickok, who we just heard from there in that extract that you just read. And you write about her with such affection, and there's such a great sense of her voice. It does actually, you do emerge from this novel feeling like you might know her or have met people like her, even though, of course, I haven't. So I was just wondering whether you could introduce her to everyone now and sort of explain for people that haven't heard of Lorena what kind of woman she was and her relationship with Eleanor Roosevelt.
Well, I don't think you're in a small group of people who never heard of Lorena Hickok.
Oh, good.
I think their story was not so much missed in history as actively cut out of history. She was Eleanor Roosevelt's great romantic partner. They were lovers for 5 years, and they were friends for 30 years after that. There are 3,000 letters between them, many of them very passionate, all of them very affectionate and very attentive, down to sort of the smallest domestic details of their lives. So I didn't come across her because I discovered a lost female journalist in American history, although she certainly could have been that. She was the first woman in America to have a byline in the New York Times. I came across her because I was researching the Roosevelts for a previous book. And if you look at the 30s and 40s in the United States, you can't really miss the Roosevelts. And there she was, sort of mentioned as first friend or an advisor or Eleanor Roosevelt's favorite reporter. She also did reports on the Depression for the president and for his cabinet. But it doesn't give you much of a sense of her. Her letters to Eleanor Roosevelt, which are in the Roosevelt Library because she donated their correspondence after editing it very, very heavily and burning about 200 much too passionate and explicit letters that she didn't want to be in the library. You just get a sense of her being straightforward and funny and frank and always an outsider in the White House. And I must say, beyond that, mostly she is a work of my imagination.
Well, yes, I mean, touching on that, I mean, there is actually, I found a great description of her from Time magazine, which was in 1934, mm-hmm. Which says, "She's a rotund lady with a husky voice, a peremptory manner, baggy clothes. In her day one of the country's best female news hawks, she was assigned back to Albany to cover the New York Executive Mansion, where she became fast friends with Mrs. Roosevelt." And I laughed out loud when I read fast friends, because it's one of those euphemisms that is used throughout history to sort of characterize their relationship as something that wasn't romantic. I mean, even the Daily Mail here, which is a tabloid newspaper, uses gal pals often to refer to lesbians.
Sure. I mean, your ribs hurt from being poked so hard when you read that stuff.
What you were saying before about their relationship being actively adjusted in terms of, it was a lesbian romantic relationship, but it's only been perhaps in the last decade, maybe two decades, that it's really been characterized as such. Because there are biographies of Lorena, but there has been dispute.
There are very few biographies of Lorena. I think there's actually one. There is a collection of letters between them called Empty Without You, which is really a charming book of letters between them. There is Doris Faber's book on Lorena Hickok, which is described as something like first friend to the first lady. But all of these narratives, including the ones that are much more mainstream about the Roosevelts, share this position that obviously Lorena Hickok was the lonely little lesbian tugboat behind the great Roosevelt cruise liner. And what I always thought about that is nobody is that in their own life. You know, we are all Hamlet. We are not the gravediggers. And the idea that this is the only way you could see this woman's life made no sense to me. She was a very successful journalist. She had a wide circle of friends. She was much loved for her wit, for her laugh, for her warmth, for her cooking. And so the idea that all she ever did was trail around Eleanor just seemed very unlikely. And then you read the letter from Eleanor to Lorena, which are passionate and jealous and possessive and loving and admiring. And you think, oh, this is in fact a great love affair.
I mean, actually, coming from this book, you perhaps go into a book where you're talking about a third party having an affair with someone who is married. You maybe assume that the third party is sort of the third wheel. Whereas reading this book, you really do feel like FDR was the third wheel, that Lorena and Eleanor had something that was sort of very rich and really honest and was going to survive despite, you know, the time that it was occurring in.
Well, I think that's true. I also think that who is the third wheel depends on where the little car is going at what particular moment. I think that, for example, FDR and Eleanor were a great alliance and a great team, except when they weren't. There were times where it was clear to me that one could easily imagine FDR and Lorena having a late night drink in which Eleanor would not participate because she didn't stay up late and she didn't like drinking.
I mean, Eleanor in particular, to see her in this book, there is this sense of Eleanor that still persists, I think, that she's sort of this sexless, unexciting figure who wasn't really, I mean, it's the proven fact that she didn't want to really be First Lady.
She didn't want to be First Lady, and it doesn't strike me as mysterious or eccentric that after her husband cheated on her with her close friend and her secretary, Lucy Mercer, she didn't want to sleep with him again. I don't know why that would lead historians to conclude that she never wanted to have sex again, only that she didn't want to have it with him.
Did you have this sense of trying to correct a perception of Eleanor when you were writing this book?
Not particularly. I mean, I think the perception of her, yes, it might have been sort of sexless and a great helpmeet, but also in America, she is really a much admired woman and sort of considered a progressive icon. So I didn't feel that there was much to correct. My strongest interest in this book was illuminating this unlikely and difficult and interesting love affair.
Was it always in your mind, did it always have to be told from Lorena's perspective? Did you ever consider Eleanor's?
No, I spent 18 months looking for the narrator.
Oh, really?
there's probably not a character in the book who didn't get a chance to audition as the narrator. But in the end, you know, Lorena nailed it. and partially because she is a journalist, and so she's a terrific observer, and she's used to writing, and so I didn't have to sort of manufacture an artificial novelist version of an observer. I mean, she was a natural observer, and the pleasure of writing a novel as opposed to a history is I could fill in everything that was missing, which was quite a bit.
On that, we do know little bits about Lorena's early life, mm-hmm. but she's also had a very interesting and very difficult early life, which lends itself to some of that brashness in her voice, the sort of no bullshit tone that she talks in. But when it comes to filling in those gaps, particularly when someone's had a difficult early life, did you ever feel any conflict about what you did fictionalize and what you just left unsaid?
I didn't really feel a conflict. I feel like I tried as hard as I could, and I think my publisher encouraged me to try hard to make it clear that it was a novel. Mm-hmm. It was not fictionalized history. It wasn't history except that I made things up. It's a novel. It's a work of imagination, and I work from the sort of a skeleton of the facts. I mean, you know, I think when you write a novel like this, there are two ways to go. One is to work from known facts, and the other one is to throw all of that out and go, nope, I'm going to make Eleanor Roosevelt a long-legged, blonde Las Vegas showgirl who marries up, and I'm going to set the Depression in 1957. And that wasn't how I saw this. I wanted to stay in the shape of the known world and then use my imagination for everything that was not known.
And with the research that you must have had to do for this book, did you go to the library?
The Roosevelt Library is delightful in Hyde Park. It really is, and they are lovely people, and it's beautiful grounds. And you put in your request, or I put in my request, to see the 3,000 letters between Eleanor Roosevelt and Lorena Hickok, and they send them out in carts, three at a time, like dim sum on brunch. And they were a joy to read. I mean, partially, they were beautiful physically because people had beautiful penmanship. And there's something very fresh and alive about reading in Eleanor Roosevelt's handwriting. I look at the ring on my finger and I think, oh, she must love me or she wouldn't have given it to me.
Hmm. Were there bits like that, or I suppose the bits that you couldn't include in the novel, bits that...
I often refer to things that are mentioned in the letters, but I don't quote the letters.
Hmm. Were there any particular parts of the letters, things like that quote you just gave about the ring, that have stayed with you that you did try to work in but perhaps didn't fit?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the famous quote from the letter is, I long to kiss you on the southeast corner of your lips and lie beside you, which is sort of the aha moment if you are a historian or a biographer in which you think, oh, perhaps they were not just pals. There's also another letter, which I just found very moving, which is later on in their relationship after they are no longer romantically involved. And in fact, Lorena has a new girlfriend who is a very attractive blonde judge and so accomplished and pretty, and they are very happy together. And there's a note from Eleanor, which is exactly the kind of letter you would write if the person who had been the love of your life and you had both broken up by mutual understanding and they had now moved on in a way that you had not. So it was affectionate and a little snarky and a little put out, and I wish you all the best, except maybe the way in which I don't, and I hope you'll be so happy. Perhaps she's a little boring. And I love that letter. I just thought, oh, there is the heart of that romance that is still enduring in the friendship.
Well, I think that's one of the lovely parts about this book, and this is something that a lot of reviewers have brought up when writing about this book, is we just don't see romantic accounts of women in their sort of middle age and later years very often, and even in straight relationships, to have two of them together, there is this richness and sense of, I don't know, womanly know-how almost that is shared between the two, that as a woman to read it is really almost reassuring, you know, to know, understand the richness of what is to come.
Well, I'm glad. I mean, it doesn't seem to me that people just drop dead at 35. And so I like writing about the long run. Mm. I like writing about the ups and downs. I like writing about the surprises. A friend of mine once said to me, you know, when you've been married for a long time, it doesn't matter that in your mind you get divorced 100 times. It only matters that in your mind you get remarried 101 times. Mm. And that's really what I wanted to write about. I wanted to write about this long enduring relationship in which they cherished each other even when it was no longer a romance. And there were ups and downs, some of which were external and some of which were internal, just like for the rest of us.
And in terms of the fictionalization that was required to create a narrative, that, you know, that to make this is a novel, not a historical account, you've got characters like Parker Fisk, mm-hmm. who I actually went, oh, he sounds amazing, he's charming, I'm going to look him up. And then I realized that you'd actually created him. So he's in the book, he plays he's a cousin to Eleanor, but mm-hmm. he's also a gay man, mm-hmm. And a very successful figure in the State Department. Mm-hmm. But he emerges as an ally of sorts. Could you talk about the process of creating him, or realizing that perhaps you needed to create him?
Well, I feel that there were two characters in the book, Missy LaHand, who was a real person, who was Franklin's secretary for many years and his mistress, and Parker Fisk, who was based on a couple of men who had been in the State Department, who were very successful and well-known diplomats, who also were very closeted gay men. And I thought, these are the two lives that Lorena gets to look at and say, do I really always want to be the tiny satellite around the big planet? Or do I want to submerge my life entirely so that no one who doesn't know us will see me at all? And I think in the end, she decides that as much as she loves Eleanor and as much as Eleanor loves her, there are ways in which she would rather be a writer, writing her books, living with her dogs, having her circle of friends, and not being the little hidden village.
And there's something that emerges, because I read Lucky Us, and something occurred to me, and it must be entirely obvious to you, that a lot of your books do take into account the historical record of gay life and often have gay characters in them, and they're not necessarily set in contemporary times. And I was wondering about why that is, why that's something that interests you. And I was sort of wondering whether this was in part to, in some ways, dispel this idea that homosexuality is a kind of modern affectation, that there is a really rich history that was just often never recorded because it was seen as sinful.
I think that I am interested in the untold stories, period. Mm. I am interested in all of those histories that are never recorded. Some seem closer to me or more accessible to me than others. But as my father used to say to me when I was studying history, don't forget, honey, the books are written by the winners. And so I feel that I always am, you know, it's a big world. And yes, the idea that homosexuality is like a skim soy latte, that if we only just came up with it in the last 10 minutes, just strikes me as hilarious. But one of the pleasures sometimes setting a book in the past rather than the contemporary world, which I also like to do, is that it just gives you room to illuminate in ways that might be more striking than if it is just the modern world and everything we know and everything we see already. Sometimes you hold it up against a different kind of background and you can see it more clearly.
That was Amy Bloom speaking with Sean Kane. The Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Lawrence Wright began his latest book, God Save Texas, after his editor at The New Yorker asked him why he still lived in the Lone Star State. When he came to the studio, he began with a reading exploring the gap between the picture we have of Texans and the way Texans see themselves.
I've lived in Texas most of my life, and I've come to appreciate what the state symbolizes, both to people who live here and to those who view it from afar. Texans see themselves as confident, hard-working, and neurosis-free, a distillation of the best qualities of America. Outsiders view Texas as the national id, a place where rambunctious and disavowed impulses run wild. Texans, they believe, mindlessly celebrate individualism and view government as a kind of kryptonite that saps the entrepreneurial muscles. We're reputed to be braggarts, careless with money and our personal lives, a little gullible, but dangerous if crossed, insecure, but obsessed with power and prestige. Indeed, it's an irony that the figure who most embodies the values people associate with the state is a narcissistic Manhattan billionaire now sitting in the Oval Office.
Lawrence, you're here to talk about your latest book, God Save Texas, which is a fascinating portrait of a state that has come to, in many ways, determine the direction of greater North America.
Right.
And you were from Texas, you're born and bred, but you have a complicated relationship with it, and you go into a lot of the different contradictions that the Texas holds, sort of as a role as an oil empire, for example, but also as one of the leaders in sustainable energy. Also, this idea that perhaps it's like this cultureless void, but also all the culture, the writers, the directors that it has produced. I mean, as an outsider, your book starts with this anecdote of you and your friend Steve stopping at the largest convenience store in the world, which, as an outsider who's never been to Texas, it sort of fits my worldview that it's this sort of very grand, big, you know, money-driven place.
Uh-huh.
But that's not necessarily fair, is it?
Well, you know, all these stereotypes about Texas are true in some ways. It's where they're not true is in the sense of how incomplete they are. And, you know, Texas is, you know, very, for instance, it's an extremely diverse state. It's one of the few states in America that is a majority-minority. It has, you know, like Houston is the most diverse city in America and has, I think, more political refugees than any other city. And Texas has always been very generous about that. You know, there are a lot of things that are confounding. Texas is a tech hub. In fact, Texas exports more technology than California does. So, you know, these things don't correspond to the image that people have in their minds when they think about Texas. It's a really powerful brand. And, you know, there's something great about it that everybody in the world has an opinion. It's not always a good one, you know, depending on their political views. When people sometimes, when they ask me, where am I from? And I say I'm from Texas. It's like saying I cheat on my taxes or something like, you know. But then if I say I'm from Austin, it seems, it's forgivable in a way that being from Texas is not.
Well, a lot of people tend to, when they travel or when they're talking to someone who's not where they're from, sometimes feel some sort of secondhand embarrassment or pride, alternating between the two about where they're from. But you get the sense that that's a very common thing for Texans, particularly in America, from your book, that there is this strange divide between Texas and the rest of the country.
Well, I felt it particularly acutely when I was a young man. I was in high school when John F. Kennedy was killed in Dallas, where I lived. And, you know, the stigma that was attached to Dallas and in another way up to Texas was really hard. And Dallas was taken down in a way that no other city in America ever has been. And I fled. You know, I didn't want to be associated with it. I didn't, you know, the idea that Kennedy was killed by, you know, by Dallas was absurd because Dallas was a right-wing empire. And Kennedy was killed by a Marxist. I didn't even know we had a Marxist in Dallas. I scarcely knew any Democrats. Mm. But it was you know, the city was held responsible for it. And that changed the attitude of the country towards Texas. Before that, Hollywood made all these movies about Texas. You know, they were usually shot in some Arizona parkland, you know, with John Wayne, you know. And those were heroic films and did so much to create the mythology that surrounds the state. But after that, it was, you know, Dr. Strangelove and, you know, Easy Rider and these films where Texas was a place where, you know, there were chainsaw massacres and stuff like that. And that's what Texas came to represent. It was an abrupt change. And it wasn't really until Texans started making their own movies that I began to see the state that I actually lived in resurrected in the film form.
Mm. I mean, you talk about Richard Linklater in the book. That idea of Texans all being sort of libertarian cowboys that are roaming the prairies or something. Just simply, it's such a powerful image that it has stuck around.
Let me tell you, I when I was a young man and I was teaching in Cairo, and I used to go horseback riding out at the pyramids. And, I'm a city boy. I'm no cowboy. But they found out I was from Texas. And they started calling me Texas. And and one day I went out there and they said, oh, Texas, we've got a horse for you. And two guys bring out this rearing stallion, his nostrils flaring, and it was scary.
Yeah,
but
I bet.
Because I was Texas, I had to get on the horse, and he took me halfway to Libya. But it was the dissonance between being a Texan and being Texas, you know, in their imagination. You know, I felt I was literally astride the myth.
I mean, you talk, I really loved, there's one of the earlier chapters is about Texas' role in energy production in America.
Yeah.
Particularly this history of it being this oil empire,
right.
And then moving into developments with fracking, and then now it's this amazing hub for sustainable energy.
Right.
And it's such a wonderful sort of fragment of Texas to look at, to sort of consider just how fast progress happens there.
Right.
Is that the sense that people have in Texas, that Texas is actually this very innovative, progressive place, no matter what the politics are?
Absolutely. I think that's what distinguishes Texas in the minds of most Texans, that it's a place of possibility. And, you know, it was, you know, people come to Texas for the jobs. And Texas has done a wonderful job of creating jobs. And that's what brought our family there. You know, my father was an itinerant banker, and he finally got the chance to be the president of this little bank. It was in a strip shopping center that he built up into a major institution. And, you know, Texas gave him that opportunity, and it's still true. People come, you know, the Texas is growing so fast, it's unsettling. The state is supposed to double by the year 2050, at which time it will be about the size of California and New York combined. And economically, it's outstripping all the other states. In the last quarter of 2017, Texas GDP grew at 5.2%. There's not a single other state that even got to 4, except for Idaho, which may be accounted for by a run on potatoes or something, I don't know. But Texas is just, you know, economically and demographically growing so quickly, and that's why I say the future of America lies in Texas.
You talk about, there's actually the fantastic quote that you use from the New Yorker writer John Bainbridge, who wrote in 1961, "Texas is a mirror in which Americans see themselves reflected, not life-sized, but as in a distorting mirror bigger than life, and they are not pleased by the image."
No.
This idea that the white of America is sort of disdainful of Texas, that there is sort of schadenfreude on a countrywide scale whenever something goes wrong for Texas, is that perhaps linked to this idea that Texas is this very prosperous, very innovative place?
Yeah, I guess that people view Texas through the lens of their politics. You know, liberals look at Texas with a certain kind of dread. You know, it's the home of Daddy Warbucks capitalism, heartless social programs, low taxes and so on. Yeah, but, you know, essentially, you know, it turns its back on the poorer people, and there's so much inequality. And conservatives look at Texas as the, you know, the kingdom of entrepreneurialism and of low government, few regulations, and where the entrepreneurial spirit runs free. Well, both of these things are absolutely accurate, but, you know, one focuses on one or the other depending on the political perspective. It's a complicated state.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my quarrel with Texas, as much as I love it, is that we're not shouldering the responsibility of becoming the leader that we are inevitably going to become. We're not educating our children. We're next to last in how much we spend on education per student, and that's reflected in our low academic standings. And we're not preparing the infrastructure for the future either. If we're going to be doubling in the space of 30 years, then we've got to get to work.
I mean, you write in the book that you feel that it has nurtured what you call an immature political culture in America.
Right.
Is that Texas is responsible for an immature political culture, or is it that it's indicative of, it foreshadows what is to happen in the rest of the country?
I think a lot of times that it's the latter point, that, you know, that things happen in Texas is a conservative political environment. And far more conservative than the actual demographics of the state.
Mm.
But things start in Texas, and then they get picked up in the national agenda. And, you know, the bathroom bill, for instance, that we argued about in the last legislative session, fortunately did not get passed, but may well on the next current one that begins in January. This is an example, I think, of the business-oriented conservatives that have run the state for so long have run out of things to do. And it's the extreme Tea Party social conservatives that are in ascendance right now in the politics of the state. And their agenda is damaging, really, to the business interests and also, I think, to the cultural environment of the state.
Mm. I mean, figures like Alex Jones, for example, who you do
done
talk
a lot
about.
Of damage.
Yeah, I mean, he has a reputation that absolutely transcends America.
Yeah,
watching it from here, he's scary.
He is scary, and I, you know, this phrase about fake news that is, you know, hurled at venerable institutions like the New York Times, you know, where, you know, compare that to the kind of conspiracy theories that are invented out of whole cloth and foisted on gullible people. It's shocking to see how people buy into these theories and how people like Alex Jones are never held to account for the harm that they do to other people and to the reputations of innocent bystanders, and mainly to the truth itself.
I emerged from your book very unsure about whether... I got the sense that you love Texas.
I do love Texas.
You do love Texas.
Yeah. But I love it enough to be critical when I feel like it needs to be corrected.
Mm. I mean, there's this idea, I think, that Texans can profess pride and embarrassment in the same breath about their country.
Yeah.
But do you think, I mean, because in terms of the politics of Texas, it's very consistently Republican.
Well, let me comment on that. When I was young, Texas was blue. It was entirely Democratic. And California was red. And Texas produced Lyndon Johnson and the Great Society, and California produced Ronald Reagan and the modern conservative revolution.
Mm.
And, you know, now they're totally opposite in the opposite manner.
Yeah.
I think of California and Texas being like strands of DNA that revolve around each other but never actually touch. But they're in this relationship, and the entire body politic of America is dependent on the dynamic between those two states. So Texas, we think of it as being red, you do, but, you know, far more cosmopolitan and progressive than its elected representatives would lead you to believe. The problem is Texans don't vote.
Mm.
We're at the bottom or near it all the time in actual voter turnout.
It's interesting to, say, talk to people who aren't American about places like Austin. Austin is always elected as this sort of liberal haven in Texas, and has this reputation for producing art and culture and all these sort of things that people don't necessarily associate with Texas unfairly.
Yeah.
But this idea, I mean, it's a very common thing for countries, I suppose, that cities tend to maybe lean towards liberal, and then rural areas tend towards Republican. But that, even with Austin being this sort of more liberal-minded, having a more liberal spirit, that whole question of voter turnout, that seems to be the thing that determines Texas's political leanings most of all, because it's not necessarily that there's more Republican voters. It's more that Republican voters are more likely to vote.
Well, they are Republican voters, whereas the Democrats are not. They're Democrats, but they're not may not be voters.
Mm.
And we had, you know, there are 29 million Texans, and 19 million of them were registered to vote before the presidential election, and only 9 million of them actually did vote. And that's interesting to think about, that they took the trouble to register. They were ready to vote.
Mm.
And why did they not? Well, of course, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton were the most unpopular candidates in the history of American presidential elections, so there was that.
Mm.
But I think, you know, all through modern Texas history, there has yet to be a candidate that appeals to, especially to the Hispanic portion of 40% of Texans are Hispanic, and they are unrepresented in the polls, and they're unrepresented in the elected bodies for the most part. When I think one day when we get candidates that really speak to the disenfranchised Texans, especially in the South, the state will turn. And that day will be a very telling event in American politics, because if Texas turns purple, it becomes a battleground state, and if it turns blue and moves into the blue column along with the largest state, California, it's very difficult to imagine any kind of political calculus where the Republicans are able to take the White House. And that's why Texas is such a preoccupation with the Republican Party.
After Trump was elected, there was this whole soul-searching going on in America that the white poor of America had come out en masse and voted, right, because they were unhappy with their lot. And Texas is always a state that's mentioned in this discussion, that Texas, but is that unfair? That it's particularly responsible in any way for Trump?
Yeah, I think that's unfair. Trump did carry Texas, but by a much lower margin than Mitt Romney had carried the state previously. Texas, 9%, same as Ohio. And I remember sitting with a group of Republicans at a speech by Karl Rove, who had done so much to turn Texas red and the whole country red. And it was early in the primary season, and one of my friends who had been elected to the Supreme Court, where in Texas we elect our judges, said, you know, y'all, if Trump gets the nomination, what are you going to do? And every single one of them, all these Republicans, said they were going to vote for Hillary Clinton. Well, that they didn't say they were going to not vote. They didn't say they're going to vote for Trump. But as far as I know, all of them now support Trump. So my reading of that is that, you know, like other places in America, Texans were ambivalent to hostile to Trump. And you look at the Bush family, for instance, and you know, the humiliation of Ted Cruz. All of those things registered with Texas. But Trump ran away with the party. There isn't a Republican Party outside of Trump right now.
To talk a little bit more widely about, I mean, this book, you play a role in the book, and quite a sort of prominent role in the book, and a lot of it revolves around you, and your friend Steve is mentioned quite a lot as well, which is really, really nice. But I'm actually just talking to you the day after Tom Wolfe has died. I was reading your book all this week, and then Tom Wolfe died yesterday, and I immediately thought of your book, because it is an example of this journalism that immerses the journalist in the story itself. And I mean, you do this with your books. I mean, you're also the author of The Looming Tower, which people may remember won the Pulitzer a few years ago, and also Going Clear. But I was just wondering whether Wolfe was an influence at all on the way you write.
He was a big influence. And I don't think any nonfiction writer my age was not influenced by him. The first thing he ever wrote, I read the candy-colored streamlined tangerine flake baby, I think it is. it was unbelievably energetic and amusing, but so surprising. And what made him unique is that he started writing about and reporting on things that we never really looked at before, like status, like the interior mind of the characters. He would, you know, it's fair game to ask people about what they thought and what they said and so on. I do that routinely now in order to create a kind of almost like a novel, a sense of, you know, what was actually going on with the character. Well, Tom was a pioneer in that. He wasn't making it up. He was reporting it and making, I think of him as being the Dickensian nonfiction writer. Certainly I fell under his sway because he made nonfiction writing seem more interesting, more exciting than writing novels. And so instead of heading in that direction, you know, I decided I would go into journalism.
With your other book, The Looming Tower, I find it so interesting to look at that, and that's now been made into a Hulu drama series, which is kind of interesting to see a book that's very firmly journalistic, but written in this way, this sort of very narrative-driven, could almost be read like a thriller, but it's all true, to be converted into a drama series. Was that quite a strange process to be involved in?
Well, I had been reluctant to do it, because, you know, 9/11 is a highly charged event in our history. And, you know, if you were seen to be exploiting it or cheapening it in some way through film or television, it would be sort of unforgivable. And yet, I was noting that there were all these young people who were going into college. They weren't born on 9/11. And those who are graduating from college now are too young to have really experienced it. And they don't know why they live in the America that they do. And they don't know why we failed to stop 9/11. And they don't know how history might have been different if we had been able to stop that plot. And they don't know that we could have and should have. So I've had a number of offers, but I found out somebody was kind of planning to do something that I wasn't sure I could trust. And I decided I better do this myself. So I enlisted Alex Gibney, who I worked with on Going Clear.
Documentary.
Yeah. And we hired Dan Futterman as our showrunner. And I guess the thing that was most enlightening to me is that television had changed. Mm. You know, to be able to do a series, 10 episodes in 8 countries, with a quality that you would associate with a high-quality film, you know, this was all new. And also, we insisted on having control of it, and they would actually get, made, not developed. The death yard for all these projects in Hollywood. And Hulu agreed to it. We didn't know anything about Hulu at the time, so we took a risk, and it turned out to be a great gamble.
No plans for a God Save Texas TV show?
I don't know. I talk in the book about how I had worked on a play called Sonny's Last Shot years ago. We had 2 productions in Austin about a young man who comes to the Capitol and tries to change politics and gets educated. And it never traveled, and so I always thought it should. And so now I'm turning it into a musical.
Oh, wow.
So we'll see if anything comes of it.
Lawrence Wright with Sean Kane. God Save Texas is published by Knopf in the US and Alan Lane in the UK. White Houses is published by Random House in the States and Granta in the UK. Next week, we'll be off to the Hay Festival with a special Saturday edition featuring Kevin Powers and all the latest from Wales. In the meantime, you can subscribe and review us on all your favourite podcatchers and join in the discussion on Twitter or on the Guardian website. Let us know if there's someone you'd particularly like to hear from at Hay. You can always email us directly on bookspodcast@theguardian.com. But for now, from me, Richard Lee, and our producer, Susanna Tresillian, goodbye and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.